Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And you know what? It's time for a roundtable discussion about Wisconsin wildlife and nature. Every so often, we invite our outdoor writers in for a visit, and they are back. Dean Bortz, the editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, one of them, Dean, with us by phone. Hey, Dean, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Larry. Good to be here.
Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Pat, I'm hoping to hear your voice, too.
Always a pleasure, Larry.
Thanks so much for coming by. And with me in the studio, Tim Isley. Tim's a full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. Lots of things we can talk about today, and certainly hope you'll join in the conversation as well. Maybe you've got a question about what's going on in the world of wildlife. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Several things related to the Natural Resources Board that I think we can touch on. Tim, maybe first you can just tell us about the board itself. I think most people listening know a bit about it, but...
Right, Larry. The Natural Resources Board is a board of citizens, seven citizens who are appointed by the governor or different governors to serve, and basically they set policy for the Department of Natural Resources. So it's really an important position. And the way it's divided up is that there has to be three members from north of Stevens Point, three members from south of Stevens Point, and then there can be one member at large. And basically, these are citizens who have different types of backgrounds but an interest in natural resources, and they set policy. And I think the really good thing, the predecessor was the Wisconsin Conservation Commission, that probably was formed in about 1927 or so for the Wisconsin Conservation Department. Then when the DNR was formed, it became the Natural Resources Board. But what I like about the Natural Resources Board is that it keeps politics at arm's length from the DNR, and it just keeps things basically a little bit isolated from the political scene. And they have to make the decisions when regulations come up, when seasons come up, when some of the rules come up. They go to public hearings, the department will make a decision, and then it goes to the board, and the Natural Resources Board has to make the decision. That's where sort of science and sociology come together.
Yeah,
and it's really
yeah.
it's a good system, and I think it's a great system to have.
And Dean Bortz, there was a resignation from the board recently. Maybe you could talk about Fred, I think it was, wasn't it?
Fred.
Yeah, Fred Clark was appointed, I think, in March. Is that right, Tim?
Correct.
At about the same time, or even a little bit prior to that, Fred was involved with a relatively new conservation group called Wisconsin's Green Fire, and he became executive director of that group. And as the summer progressed and he attended meetings, Fred could see that there's going to be conflict, potential for conflict, between Wisconsin's Green Fire and Natural Resources Board decisions. And he didn't feel that he could be do justice to Green Fire and the board, or, you know, would end up maybe having to make decisions as a board member on issues that Green Fire is opposed to. So he ended up resigning at the September Natural Resources Board meeting. So we'll, I'm sure at some point here in the next week or two, maybe three, we'll hear of a new nominee from Governor Evers to fill that spot.
Yeah.
Right. Fred was also, he's from Madison, so his spot has to be taken by somebody in the southern part of the state. So I would expect, as Dean said, I would expect that the governor will be naming somebody within the next couple of weeks before the October Natural Resources Board meeting, and that person will have to be from the southern part of the state. We've had two members who were appointed by Governor Evers, Fred Clark down here, and then Bill Smith up in Shell Lake. And so and we don't know what he's looking for, but those people both had backgrounds in natural resources, and I would have a hunch it would be somebody with some background in natural resources.
The board's decision, Pat, was to shorten the ruffed grouse season. What are your thoughts on that?
Before I forget, Larry, one thing Tim can probably, he knows better than I do. Tim, what is the current makeup? I think there's also, by law, we have to have, three board members who have a hunting background or something? How's that work?
I think that did pass not too long ago. That there at least three of them have had a hunting or fishing or trapping license within the last so many years, and then one of them has to also have an agricultural background, and that's where Bill Bruins from Waupun, who's a full-time farmer.
Yeah.
So it has to be one farmer and then at least three of them. There have been some other proposals for other backgrounds, but I think those are the only ones at this point.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Hate to hijack your show there, Larry.
No. That's all right. I mean, I'm glad you did, because that's important to know, too.
Okay. Yeah. The board decided at its last meeting to, once again, for the second year in a row, do an emergency order to shorten the grouse season. And, you know, the area that is shortened is basically most of the state. The only area it doesn't affect is the southeastern portion of Wisconsin. But the decision was to shorten the season from the January 31st closure to January 5th. And so and then also there's a underway right now is the state's rough grouse management plan, and that plan will also is calling for a shorter season. So it'll be it's two straight years with the shorter season, and primarily in the north is where a lot of guys would hunt, but it was never a real popular, wasn't a lot of participation in that late January hunt. So I guess people like me were really opposed to it, because there really wasn't any real scientific explanation or justification to shut the season down early like that.
Yeah. Tim, you may agree or not agree with Pat on that one.
Well, right. I support what the board did. When you look back, some things are, you know, based on science, but then sociology comes in. But I think it was just precautionary from what I understand, because it was back in 2018 that I think the rough grouse drumming counts went down 30-some percent, and then the grouse harvest went down. And then we've learned about West Nile virus, and they actually picked up some dead grouse. It was in 2018, and there were like three of them that were found to have had West Nile virus in them, and I think another five out of 16 birds, about half of them, had something else. It was a equine virus in them. So there's a lot that they don't know, and I think the problem is they just don't have enough science at this point to really know. So it's precautionary. But I think it's a combination. You need young forest, successional forest for grouse. So whether that young forest and the West Nile virus, the two of them combined, are making an impact. Other states, I think Indiana was thinking of putting grouse on the endangered list, and Pennsylvania was actually talking about closing the season. It all goes down to young forest habitat, but there's a lot we don't know. So from my standpoint, it was precautionary. I think it was a good move, but I know a lot of other people think, well, there isn't the science there, and I understand that.
Yeah, I understand that. Tyler, we got a drummer. Let's hear that. Oh, there's nothing better than to hear that in the woods.
Beautiful.
Isn't it? Well, let's take a related issue. Dean, maybe you can talk about the mechanical feeders issue in relation to CWD.
Okay, well, that's probably coming out of a report that was given to the Natural Resources Board by a subcommittee. And when you have a subcommittee on a Natural Resources Board that only has seven members, your subcommittee is small, so it was two people. It was Greg Kazmierski and Fred Clark, the guy that is just resigning now. And we will be reviewing that report here in the Outdoor News and print over the next couple of issues. Not the one coming out next, but the one after.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that I read through it quickly to see what the report said, I wasn't too surprised by what I read in there once I knew who wrote it. The primary author was Greg Kazmierski, and it just left me shaking my head quite a bit. I'll leave it at that for now, other than to address your point, your question about mechanical feeders. In a day and age when we're trying to deal with CWD, anybody who thinks that allowing the use of mechanical feeders to, I just don't know where this is. Man, wow. So I'm glad that Fred wrote a dissenting report, although Fred was very kind in his dissent.
Oh.
So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just don't think it's a good idea. You know, even though Greg specified that the mechanical feeders be used only in counties that still do allow deer baiting and feeding, you know, I mean, it's a very, I mean, if it's, I guess you could call it a point if he wants to argue it, but I don't know that it's a point even worth spending any breath on as far as like spreading the corn out would give the deer less chance to stand nose to nose when they're feeding on it. But I mean, you're still drawing them together. I mean, what the heck? Put it away. Put it away, man. Stop. Just stop.
But
that's my thought.
But what do you really think?
Well,
let's talk about
tomorrow with a six pack, Larry. Tomorrow with a six pack, and I'll let you know.
Well, the whole business of deer baiting and feeding rules is, Dean.
Pardon me.
I say the whole business of deer baiting and feeding rules needs to be looked at. Perhaps.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I could spend hours on this subject. I mean, I first ran into it in 1980 in Ashland County, the first winter after I ETS'd out of the U.S. Army. And prior to that, I'd never seen a kernel of corn anywhere in Ashland County. And I get back home and I try to hunt and I see, oh, crap, look at all these deer tracks. What a, you know, this trail is just pounded. So I sat on that thing from opening morning until the last light on opening day, and I didn't see a deer. I didn't see one. And I think, where did all these deer go? And it snowed overnight. So prior to shooting hours on the second morning, I went and checked the trail. Holy crap, it's pounded open. All this snow is gone. So I sat there again all day. I didn't see a deer.
Oh,
well, I eventually figured out what was going on, and that was pretty much the end of it for me. I mean, I've been opposed to baiting and feeding ever since then, and I just think it hasn't done one good thing for our hunters, hunting culture, hunting traditions, woodsmanship skills, nothing. So that's where I'm at on that one.
Taking a look at all kinds of wildlife issues today with our three guests, our outdoor writers back once again, and I'll invite you to join in. I haven't given the number here in a bit, so let me do that. Our guest, Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. Pat Durkin is a freelance writer and editor, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. Questions for them. What do you think about baiting? What do you think about the Natural Resources Board? Other wildlife issues that you'd like to bring up or questions? We're going to talk about bow hunting in a minute, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Ditter, as I said, our engineer today. Stephanie Hoff, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at nature with our Wildlife Writers Roundtable for fall with our three guests, Dean Bortz, Pat Durkin, and Tim Isley. I'm Larry Mueller. Questions or comments for these guys? What are your thoughts about shortening the grouse season? Or do you have questions about the Natural Resources Board? Maybe bow hunting, baiting? Love to hear from you. Or maybe just have a general outdoor question. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Matt from Wausau emailed, he's been monitoring trail cams in Bayfield County for more than a decade. Used to see all kinds of animals, fox, coyote, wolf, bobcat, bear, but they kind of abruptly stopped. Now all he sees are deer and the occasional turkey. He's wondering if there's a decline in mammals in Wisconsin. And, you know, sometimes if he's had that cams in the same area all the time, You know, the over that many years, the habitat changes quite a bit.
And sometimes some of the big bucks also can be a little bit leery. They see that flash go off, and I understand that sometimes they do change their movements. But it's unusual that he isn't seeing things now, I think. But I haven't heard of anything where the mammals have been declining, so it is unusual.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the numbers, I don't think there's any shortage of coyote.
No.
Dean, go ahead.
I'm just thinking back of what we've been covering here for the past few months. I mean, bear numbers are up. Wolf numbers are up. There's no shortage of coyotes, raccoons. I can't imagine, you know, we have plenty of bobcats. I really wouldn't have a good explanation as to why he's not getting pictures of all those other mammals other than just pure happenstance. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I'd agree. And, you know, like wolves, what do they occupy? About a 50-mile square radius that they sort of hunt and live in. And they tend to move a little bit, but, I mean, if they move 5 miles, that's going to make a big difference in the other animals that you're going to see. Almost for sure.
Yeah, if you had a camera in a pack, in the middle of a pack area, I wouldn't expect that you'd see a wolf on it, you know, every day. It'd be like at once every week and a half, 2-3 weeks, you know, whenever they happen to pass through.
Yeah, I know it has an effect on the deer in the area where I hunt in Bayfield County, where there's a pack, and when the pack's in the immediate area, you're not going to see very many deer, and you can almost always tell when they've moved a ways because then they're back. Well,
right.
Bob, you know, there are lots of callers online with questions, so we should go to the phones. Bob in Barron County, or I'm sorry, Barron, Wisconsin, it's your turn.
Yeah, two things. A question about CWD. When CWD first started show up, and it was traced back to some of the deer farms, the DNR was very quick to turn that over to the Department of Agriculture. And now the last outbreak of CWD, as I understand it, came from an elk that escaped a game farm. I guess I'm curious about what's being done to control some of these deer farms so that we don't have more of that happening. And my comment is that I'm 75 years old and hunted every deer season that I've been here when I wasn't in the Army. And I hunt the forests that probably have a lot of farmland around it. And some of these larger farms, I have noticed that they will leave quite a lot of crops on the ground or in the field. And I very, you know, slowly realized that I was seeing less and less deer in the acorns in the places that I was used to. And the last probably 15 years or 10 years at least, I'd never see a deer if I didn't put bait out. So I understand being the purist, but I still like venison an awful lot. I'll take my answers off the call.
Okay, Bob, thank you so much for calling. Well, who wants to tackle Bob's comment about CWD? Pat, do you want to do that?
Sure. Yeah, the first thing we should talk about when it comes to the game farms and CWD is there was never actually a direct trace back to a deer farm when they originally found CWD. In fact, when you go back and look at you know, the early days of the disease and where it was found, and there was never that bullseye target that you typically see with a wildlife disease where you'll see the epicenter and then this outward spread, almost like ripples on a pond as the disease starts moving out. There's never been that real classic example of it in Wisconsin. So it's I mean, that's always been speculated that that's how the disease got here, that it came across the Mississippi River in a truck of some sort. But there's really no direct link that you can say with certainty that that's how it got here. So I guess I'm not skeptical of that. I'm just saying you can't really prove that. So I guess that's where I'd start, Larry.
Tim, go ahead.
The other thing is that I think Bob mentioned that the DNR had handed it off to the Department of Agriculture. Right. And actually, it was the legislature which they gave the Department of Natural Resources the authority to have authority over the fences on deer farms, but not regulating deer farms. It's the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection that they're the agriculture specialists, and they're the ones who work with the deer farms. So DNR
kind of had their hands tied on that in a way. I mean, they really couldn't step into that.
Yes, exactly. And just the same thing with feeding and baiting, and that the legislature has said that they can't make those laws outlawing baiting of deer. And so that sort of is in their lap, I think.
Yeah. And what about his comment? You know, he makes, in a way, it can sound like a reasonable comment about not seeing any deer, you know, for a long period of time. But, I mean, how do you respond? Well, let me go back to Dean for that. What would you respond to our caller?
Well, you know, I hear that a lot. And I don't want to oversimplify it and say it's an excuse, because it's probably a little more than an excuse. But, I mean, man, you know, there's ways to get deer without having to put bait down, even if you're hunting around ag areas. You know, deer, in my experience, deer like acorns one heck of a lot better than they like corn. So if you can find acorns, you're going to find deer there eventually.
Yep. Well, Steve in Antigo has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hello. I'm a avid deer hunter up here in Langlade County, and some of the my favorite woods to hunt in, there's farm fields nearby that right now just have weeds and grass growing in them, and they're dumping liquid manure today because it's a sunny day, and we know it's going to rain for the next couple of days. I'm wondering, has anybody ever figured out, is it safe to eat a deer that's been drinking runoff water and puddled liquid manure type water on farm fields?
Well, you're getting a lot of silence here. What do you guys think? Well, Tim, let's go to you.
Sure. I'm not aware of any studies on that, but I do know that when the farmers spread manure in the fields, you will find, like, pheasants will be out there, turkeys will be out there. I mean, they refer to it as the hot lunch program. Mm. And so they're out there getting some of the kernels of corn and things that have passed through the animals. But, you know, I haven't heard of any studies on this, nothing to my knowledge.
No.
And the thing, too, Larry, is that deer don't need to drink from an actual water source to get their necessary intake of water every day. They can get it from eating good vegetation, any number of ways that they can get that off the land without having to go to an actual stream or an actual creek, whatever it might be. But, yeah, if you have a good water hole, they'll definitely take advantage of that. But I just have not heard anything about deer being having a problem with that kind of, you know, situation. If it's that repulsive of a smell, I doubt they're going to put their nose in there if it's, like, pooled.
Yeah.
So, and if they brought it, a touch of, even if they get a touch of it somewhere, the deer do have a much stronger digestive system than a typical modern human does.
There we go. Thank you very much, Steve, for calling. I appreciate it. Alex in Hollandale, we'll go to you next. Hi, Alex.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, Buddy and I were out hunting this morning. We got a doe, and the question that we have is we'd like to donate our hide to some purpose. And is there a website or any place anybody knows? Every year we get about 10 deer, and we throw these hides out in the field now because nobody wants them. Any ideas?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So
I always, Larry, there's a number.
It's Pat, by the way.
Yeah, it's not. I'm sorry, Larry. It's Pat. It's not that hard to find places to take hides. You know, I know in any place the Fleet Farm store takes them, there's various charity organizations that usually hold deer hide drives, where they'll collect them. I just dropped off some deer and an elk hide there at a local charity near us here in Wapaka. And I also know, I always see this taxidermist up on Highway 45 and Elko that takes them. So I would think if you called around, looked around in newspapers or it might be, you can usually find someone nearby. Because, yeah, I agree, it's terrible to let that deer hide go to waste. They can definitely be used.
Yeah, we've over the years, I don't remember how many. My dad probably had 25 or so hides that we always had them processed.
Mm-hmm.
And then gloves and coats and all kinds of things were just made, from the results of that, which are kind of really nice things to have for yourself, too. So there you go. Lots of places, Alex. Appreciate your call. Pat in Three Lakes. We'll go to you next. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how are you? Good call. Good show. I mean, I have three real quick things. Number one, baiting of deer. I'm concerned about baiting of deer because one of your gentlemen just said that there's nothing ever traced back to the game farms. And we have three counties closed down because we had CWD in a game farm here, so we can't bait anymore. Number two is that even though we can't bait, the service stations are selling just as much bait as they did before, so there are people that are abiding by the law, and other people just don't give a damn. And then the third thing is that, if deer have to breed in order to, perpetuate the species, and that's a lot more closer contact than it is in eating. So why is, why are we banning baiting when we're not banning breeding?
Well,
maybe you guys could answer some of those. Thanks a lot.
Well, that sounds like a question Dean Bortz could answer right off the top of his head.
Yeah, but I don't know if I can say it on the air, Larry. maybe the Bucks are wearing condoms. I don't know.
Oh,
We might as well take number three first, huh?
Yeah.
I don't have a good scientific answer to that one, other than I'm guessing that the nose-to-nose while feeding is a different type of contact than the one described by our gentleman caller there. And so I'm guessing that the contact he's describing isn't going to pass on the CWD prions. It may pass on something else, but not the prions.
Well, and then what about his comments about baiting? Even though their baiting is outlawed in the three areas, counties around him, they're still selling baiting materials like crazy.
Well, I can address that one too, Larry. This is Dean again. In fact, over the weekend, we had the youth deer hunt this past weekend, and I've received a number of calls and emails from readers and people, well, also people who don't read aren't subscribers, but read the paper secondhand or however you want to say it, and they're just, downright upset. You drive around, I live in the Monaco Woodruff area. I get down, to Wausau, up to Ironwood, all over the place. And you go past any gas station, any store, there's corn stacked up. They're still baiting, feeding seed stores all over the place. They're making money. They're selling product. Even though our counties, have bans, I've talked to some wardens. They are making cases. I don't know that they're going at it real hard. But if they're, told about it or made aware of it, they'll at least stop by and have a conversation, even if they don't write a ticket. But what I heard about mostly over the weekend, believe it or not, was a lot of nighttime shooting. And the nighttime shooting wasn't coming from somebody sitting out over a hayfield. It was coming from, people would call me saying, look, I heard a shot at 11:30 at night, four houses down. So there's still people who aren't following the rules, and a number of them, not just the no baiting, no feeding, but we're not supposed to be shooting deer under spotlights in the backyard either. And so that besides the illegal activity, they're also wondering, well, what are we teaching our kids if either the parents have to be shooting the deer at night, or B, they're allowing the kids to shoot them at night.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we got that going on too.
Neil in Sussex, your turn, Neil. Hi, thanks for calling.
Larry, thanks for taking my call. Your guests being outdoor writers and active hunters, I'm hoping maybe you could clarify something that confuses me. we all know that deer are doing a lot of damage out in the forest. I live in southern Wisconsin in an oak area. You can't find a young oak in the forest because the deer are browsing them. But every time a question comes up at the Conservation Congress meetings about possibly expanding the gun hunting season, hunters are generally opposed to that, and I've never understood the reason for that. And maybe you could explain that to me.
All right, Neil, good question. Thanks very much for calling. Who wants to chime in here?
I can take that if you want, Larry.
Pat, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, Wisconsin has this long history, and you can go back into the 1930s and 1940s, back in Alden Leopold's time when he was trying to convince hunters that it's letting deer take down their resource, you know, their food resource. And the only way you can control that long, give that long-term guarantee of a good food source is to keep the deer herd in check. Fortunately, hunters have this history of always kind of taking away their future, so to speak, by hitting that thing. And you need to start having the situation we have now where you have southern Wisconsin with, we've had too many deer in the landscape for at least, you know, a generation here of humans. And I have friends, too, that have the same problem. They cannot get oak regeneration down in that region. But I think a lot of it comes from the fact that a lot of these guys who are making these demands and to see more deer, that they always want to see more deer, they aren't the ones that have to deal with all the consequences of that many deer in the landscape. So whether it's crop damage, whether it's forest damage, car damage, they typically aren't the ones bearing the biggest burden there. So it's I think it's unfortunate, but I guess I always come back to the fact that better men than me, better men than the current biologists have made the same arguments for 80, 90 years now, and we still kind of get the same resistance to that science.
Yeah, Tim Isley.
Sure. I think it's sort of human nature that you try and something that you're interested in and you want to save it, And I think that's where maybe hunters, they didn't want to take too many deer. But as Pat indicated, back during Leopold's time, there was an organization called, I think, Save Wisconsin's Deer. And he was trying to get people to shoot the does. We had too many. Yeah. And basically to reduce the population. So it's gone on ever since then that people are afraid of taking too many deer. But the other thing is, as Neil indicated, people don't realize what the forest should look like. You need to go into the woods now and you see what's there, but they don't know what it should look like if you had a lower deer population, if you had more oak seedlings, if you had more white pine seedlings, things like that. So people don't realize what the high deer population is doing, and that's where it comes back to a matter of science and having biologists and people in research with a DNR that has a research emphasis to basically to recommend those things. And that's what we need. But I think it's human nature to do that.
It's absolutely amazing to visit an area where someone from the UW or maybe Madison or Stevens Point or the DNR has put an exclosures,
right,
in a woods or in an alfalfa field. I've seen some of those where the difference inside that area where deer can't get in to the woods or even the alfalfa field is absolutely mind-boggling, the diversity and what you see in those exclosures. And you guys have all seen those too, I'm sure.
Yeah. Bud Jordahl used to make a great point, you know, to get to Tim's point about we don't really know what we're missing. And Bud Jordahl would always ask people, when's the last time you saw a trillium in southern Wisconsin? You know, this beautiful wildflower that, you know, I have memories of my grandmother protecting them in our backyard and on the west side of Madison back in the 60s, you know, twice. Taking care of them, but I think I can't think the last time I saw a trillium out in the wild, because the deer, as soon as they pop up, they eat them off. So those are the kind of things that we just, you know, if you don't see them, you don't realize it's even missing.
Yeah, and I can remember seeing that photo of that alfalfa field, which was completely at one height, except in the exclosure area where it was another 6 to 8 inches taller.
Yeah.
It had been literally just evened out across the whole field by deer. So there you go. But, you know, you take a guy like Orrin Rongstad back in the day who said, okay, we ought to shoot fawns, and, you know, and he was just almost vilified for bringing that up. He was a wildlife ecologist here at the UW. So Neil, I don't know if we answered your question, but I think you got some good perspectives from our guys here. Thanks a lot for that question. Grayson,
hey,
yeah, go ahead, Dean.
Yeah, this is Dean. Yeah. One other part of that, I think he asked, you know, why couldn't we have a longer season?
Oh, yeah.
We didn't really touch on it. Yeah, so we've talked about that. We've tried to get, when I say we, I mean the different groups of hunters over the years have tried to get a longer deer season. And it's never really made it anywhere. And I kind of, the arguments against it or the tension or feelings against it, I kind of picked up a little bit on, I think, in the discussion about the shorter grouse season. You know, there was a survey, you know, of grouse hunters saying, do you support an early closure? And a lot of them did. And the question, I think, afterwards was, is it because they were a little bit selfish, saying, I don't really hunt in January and I don't want anybody else to either? It's sort of a... And so we kind of see that on the deer side, too. I don't really want to hunt more than 9 days. I don't want somebody to shoot the buck that I might be able to shoot next year if I don't hunt longer than 9 days. So I don't want them to hunt longer than 9 days either. So we have a little bit of that woven into all of this.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's this, just the tradition. The 9 days has been going on for a long, long time. People, many people just are resistant to that change. Grace in New Glarus will give you a chance. Hi, Grace.
Hello. Hey, guys. This is a great show, Larry, but, of course, most of yours are. So,
thank you.
I'm a retired wildlife ecologist and epidemiologist, so I used to go around the country and teach people about chronic wasting disease. I can say that at the Wildlife Disease Associations back in the 90s, early 90s, there were lots of discussions about the fact that there were problems with chronic wasting disease that we were never going to get rid of out in Wyoming and such, around what used to be a scrapie research station, and put deer and elk in there, and they came down with chronic wasting disease. And that movement of animals from out there to game farms should be stopped. And there were constant heated discussions that the state said, this is interstate transport, so the federal government ought to take charge of it. And the federal government would say, these are game animals. The states should take charge of it. So these questions and concerns and issues about shipping deer and elk all over the country have been going on for quite a long time. As far as the ruffed grouse and the disease problems, that's definitely an area that should be researched. I know that down here in Greene County, I've got friends who have talked about used to have rough grouse on their property, and they never hear them anymore. Part of that could be due to habitat changes and lack of the young succession, lack of the aspen trees and such that they need for their winter forage. So, and as far as people not seeing small and medium-sized mammals up in areas where there are now increased bear populations and wolf populations, there are some issues of exclusion. You know, coyotes don't necessarily want to hunt where the wolves are. Foxes can sneak in around there, but they become much more wary. So,
yeah.
Here are a few comments.
Well, Grace, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Guys, any comments back for Grace?
I think we should ask Grace about the one gentleman's question about the how the deer procreate and not contact CWD.
Well, actually, Grace may know. I mean, is contact really nose-to-nose, or could it be on other circumstances as that earlier guy talked about?
Well, there's ground contamination from, and actually Mike Samuel is probably the guy you should have on to address some of that question.
Yeah.
Mike has, done studies looking at that. We know that the soil becomes contaminated with prions wherever they come from, whether they're coming from respiratory secretions, saliva, urine, whatever it is. So if you've got an infected deer out there, and it gets to a stage and it starts excreting prions in various bodily fluids, you've got contaminated soil, you've got contaminated environment.
Yeah.
And good luck.
Good luck. Grace, thank you so much. I've had some questions about exclosures, and we'll get back to that. But just a reminder, our guest today, Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to our nature and wildlife writers roundtable now here for fall. We usually have our guys come by once a season and talk about what's going on in the world of wildlife and nature. Dean Bortz, Patrick Durkin, and Tim Isley with us today. Larry Mueller here. You can join in with your questions. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or phone in at 800-642-1234. We were talking about deer exclosures earlier, and I thought I mentioned that they were fenced in areas the deer couldn't get into, just so that researchers could take a look at, you know, what are the effects if deer can't get into an area. And so that's what an exclosure is. It excludes, you know, through fencing, primarily some pretty sturdy and tall fencing, the deer from a particular spot in a field or in the woods. And that's what that is all about. And someone, I wanted to, James from Hillsboro emailed in to say that every Lions Club, well, or at least many Lions Club in Wisconsin accepts deer hides. So he thought everyone did, but you should probably check. You could check your local Lions Club. For our earlier caller, if they are accepting, there you got a place right in your own neighborhood where you can donate your deer hide. So that's another good spot. And Tim, you wanted to mention, our last caller mentioned Dr. Mike Samuel.
Right. I thought Grace nailed it, quite frankly. And she had mentioned Dr. Mike Samuel, who retired from UW Cooperative Wildlife Research unit here in Madison, and he's given a lot of testimony to the different chronic wasting disease committees that have met in Madison here. And I think, you know, we talked about this, the CWD report that the board came out with, and a lot of the things that I'm seeing are window dressing. And what Dr. Mike Samuel is saying is, number one, prevalence. We've got to reduce the prevalence of the disease. And I'd like to see just more attention given to what Dr. Samuel is saying. And I think Grace nailed it when she said that.
Let's go to Bruce in Duluth, Minnesota next. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I hunt in Sawyer and Bayfield County, a grouse hunter. Like the area a lot, and I've noticed an increase in the number of wild turkeys over the last decade, and wondering if there's any research regarding the impact wild turkeys potentially could have on the juvenile grouse population.
I don't know if there's been anything on that or not. Tim, do you know?
Well, to my knowledge, it has never been documented in research that grouse will prey on turkeys. I did interview somebody once from up around Price County who had a trail camera out and had a photograph of a turkey at a rough grouse nest. Now, whether that turkey was just passing by or what, you don't know. But I know that the biologists, and talking to the biologists, I mean, they're saying that, of course, the grouse need the young successional forest. Wild turkeys like the older forest. Granted, they overlap a little bit, but a lot of people are pointing to wild turkeys as far as being the reason for the downturn in grouse. And it's sort of what turkeys were going up, grouse were going down. So it's just one of those things. But the biologists are all saying that it's the young successional forest. People don't want to cut their woods. And as we've lost that forest, we've lost our grouse. So, there, you know, I don't think there's been anything documented, but a lot of people, because of the turkey population going up and being so high and grouse going down, they like to point to that. And whether that's just happenstance, but I know the biologists don't think there's anything to that.
No. So there we go. John in Sturgeon Bay, your turn. Hi, John.
Hey, guys. Great show as always. So just kind of a cool thing up in a cabin is up there in Clam Lake.
Yep.
And spent a lot of time up there and saw a moose about 3 weeks ago right on Highway 77. I actually almost hit it, got some good photos, and then which is a first for us. And then I just saw a picture of another one just north of us up off of Namakagan, Lake Namakagan, and it was a different bull. The one I saw was maybe 3 years old, 2 to 3, and this was a little younger than that. So that was interesting. I don't know if there's any, if you guys have heard anything, why all of a sudden a couple of them got pushed down. Kind of neat. And then my grouse update is just I'm seeing lots of birds, lots and lots of birds. So, and I think as all the elk habitat is being developed in that area, the grouse are doing really well. So, and I haven't found any diseased birds this year at all. So, again, great show, guys.
Thank you very much for calling. Well, maybe Dean wants to comment on the moose and so forth.
Yeah, in fact, a good friend of mine, him and his wife, have some land up Iron County, west of Mercer, between Mercer and Turtle Flanville. And they had a photo of a bull moose, a young bull moose, on their trail camera about 2 weeks ago. Now, and then around the same time, a bull moose was spotted going right through Mercer. Whether it's the same one or not, probably a good chance that it is. It's not, but it's not that. You know, I know your caller just saw one and thought maybe it's the first one that was ever seen in Wisconsin. But I mean, they're beyond regular visitors. We have moose that I'm pretty sure spend the whole year here. You get around Springstead, Lac du Flambeau, Manitouish Waters, Mercer. People are seeing moose. I wouldn't say regularly, but often enough to where, you know, and it's multiple animals. I mean, there'll be cows, calves, young bulls, old bulls. So we have, I don't know if we can call it a resident herd, but I don't know why we couldn't. And maybe it's not quite a herd. We have resident individuals. But we do have moose and sure that came down from the UP. But they're here.
Yeah, they are. I can remember seeing some tracks in Bayfield County in the Shawamigan National Forest one time that I looked at those tracks and they were way too big for a deer, and I'm sure they weren't a horse. my next guest was moose.
Yeah.
So
Bunch could also make his comment about seeing lots of grouse. I have heard anecdotally from a number of hunters who say they're having a really good season so far. They're seeing a lot of birds.
Yeah. And that's good news for sure.
Yeah.
Thanks for that question and that comment, Terry. Appreciate it very much. Bob in Wisconsin Dells, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. I've got a bear in my backyard that's chasing after my beehives, and I kind of got him to quit doing that by putting up an electric fence. But my question is bears becoming more prevalent or more heavily populated in the southern part of the state?
Yeah, Tim, you want to go on?
They sure are. Bears have been moving south, and even now in the new bear management plan, you find some new regulations and some new seasons down in southern Wisconsin. And bears have been, as they've been moving out, they've been moving further south. And maybe part of it also is as our forest has been maturing. I found that out very much, as Bob indicated, of myself over in Crawford County, our little log cabin over in Crawford County, 2 years ago, when all of a sudden there was something moving out on the porch of the cabin, and I went down to look at night, and here was a black bear standing there looking at me about 3 feet away through the glass. I almost died. This was a large, mature black bear in Crawford County, and he eventually ambled on down, and it had been raining. I saw these big, wet footprints on the pine boards. It was unbelievable. He was a big bear. But they have been. They're moving further south, and we're seeing more and more of them in southern Wisconsin.
Yeah, very cool. Thank you very much, Bob. Appreciate it. Linda in Menominee, your turn.
Yeah, Larry, this is Brenda, not Linda.
Oh, Brenda, hi.
Hi. resources for deer hikes. We do black powder reenactments, the mountain man eras, and there is always somebody looking for deer hikes.
Great.
And so, they would brain tan them, so if they could throw the brains in a bag and throw the hide in the freezer with the brains, some of these guys pay pretty good money for it because a lot of our clothing and everything is brain tan deer hides.
All right, Linda. So reenactors, so your group and probably any reenactor group would be interested in something like that. Ah, thank you very much for, well, we're finding out there are a lot of places you can either sell or give away your deer hides. That's wonderful. Well, we've got questions coming up about the black powder gun season, about public trust doctrine questions, about some more rough grouse news for the southern part of the state, and a whole lot more with our three guests today. Dean Bortz of the Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. We're going to take a quick look at the news, the weather. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the IdeasNet. And then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking about nature and wildlife in Wisconsin today, Larry Mueller here with my three guests, Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. Our lines are all filled. We got some emails coming in at ideas@wpr.org. We'll go right back to the phones, I guess, and go to Terry in Milwaukee. Terry, hello.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I was wondering if the guests are aware of any effort that's ever been put forth to try to bring the black powder deer hunting season ahead of the regular deer hunting, gun hunting season. I know for me, for decades now, I'd love to take a crack at the black powder, but it's always so late in the year, and it's right after the gun season when the deer are mostly spooked and very difficult to hunt after being chased around for 11 or so days.
Who wants to, Dean, are you familiar with that?
Yeah. Yes, I am. I've been around long enough to say that I'm familiar with that. That big effort, there was a big effort made, or at least a bit of an effort made to bring that about in the 1980s. And the result of trying to get a muzzleloader season prior to the gun season is what we have now. Whoever was opposed to it, and I guess I can't remember what groups were opposed to it, but whoever was opposed to it said, okay, well, we'll support it if you put it after the gun deer season. And so, because of the other comment that your caller made about deer being chased around for a while, you know, by the time the black powder season rolls around, when I went to the after the gun deer season, they just said, you know what, let's not even have a separate license. You know, there's not going to be that many people doing it. We just let it run. You know, you take your regular gun season license. If it's unfilled, you can carry it right over into the muzzleloader season and keep right on it going. And so there was a bit of an effort made to bring one in prior to the gun season in the 1980s, but it just didn't have enough steam.
Is it true that you can use it? Somebody else wonders. Is it true you can use it black powder during the regular gun season?
Sure. Yeah, you can do that.
Yeah, I was pretty sure of that too. Otherwise, a friend of mine would have been violating for sure.
Yeah. No, that's allowed. Yeah.
Okay.
And of course, the question is, why would you do that if you can use a rifle? But I mean, if you're hunting on your own land and you want to use a black powder rifle, I mean, they're fun to shoot. I enjoy it.
Yeah. There we go, Terry. Thank you again for that question. Lucas in Madison. Hello.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to say that your show is definitely one of the few things that I look forward to. Late morning commute. So thank you for always having great programming.
Thank you.
My first question was about the rough grouse population. I was just curious, is that mostly in northern Wisconsin? Is there a lot in southern Wisconsin? And I just have been hearing the wrong parts of your show, or what? And then my second question really quick, is there a name for that song that you play when you come back to your show? It sounds kind of like a folk song. Your producer said it might just be a snippet of music, but...
I can answer that one, Lucas, and that I don't think it has a name. It's something that one of our people who works here at Wisconsin Public Radio kind of put together for us. So it's just a piece of something that he did. So there you go. And in terms of the grouse population, Tim, you're a southern Wisconsin guy.
Sure. I'm in Madison here, and we used to have a lot more ruffed grouse in southern Wisconsin, and especially in southwestern Wisconsin, the Driftless region. And I know it used to be years and years ago that they used to say that the grouse population down in southwest Wisconsin, it never had the high highs that you had up in northern Wisconsin. We have a lot of aspen, but you also never had the low lows, because rough grouse go on about a 10-year cycle, sort of similar to a roller coaster, normally high and low. And so, but it was always steady, and it was always good. And I know people who had hunted years ago in Crawford County, Richland County, they talked about all the rough grouse. And right now, to be honest with you, we don't have a lot of grouse down there. And most of the biologists, the people who have done research, Scott Walter, who is now with the DNR, he did some research when he was with UW Richland, a professor there, and he actually tracked grouse, put radio transmitters on them, watched them as they had their young. They'd have their young, and then as the hen would lead out of the thick areas into the open woods, they get picked off by predators. So the problem is we don't have the young forest. But there are ruffed grouse around. They're not a lot in southern Wisconsin. But it used to be that we had a lot more, especially over in southwestern Wisconsin.
There we go. Lucas, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I just wanted to bring up before we go back to the phones that we got an email, a share email, to say that the Raptor Education Group in Antigo accepts fresh or frozen deer hearts to feed the raptors in their care. That's Marge Gibson's group, I bet. So... something else to hang on to and get to the Raptor Education Group in Antigo. So frozen deer hearts.
They're not getting mine.
You eat your deer heart. That's Pat. But there are people who don't, and they just sit in the... they wind up sometimes just in the woods where a bear or whatever might have a taste of it. But that's good to know that they're accepting those deer hearts.
Any idea, Larry, do they take the liver?
I don't know if they take the liver. She just mentioned deer hearts. The Raptor, actually, if you went to the Raptor Education website, it would probably be listed. There might be something, or shoot an email, or maybe Marge Gibson's listening and can call us and tell us.
Marge has a great organization up there, but also just the question also brings up the need, because as Pat was indicating, and a lot of other people leave the organs in the woods, just another reason for hunters to consider using non-toxic ammunition. Right now, I mean, because when people use lead bullets, It's in the deer, they leave it there in the woods, and it's possible that eagles feed on that, and they get lead poisoning. And there's been a lot of interest and a lot of research lately. The non-toxic bullets are, I think, as effective as the lead ones, and it doesn't leave the lead out there in the organs that you've left in the woods from cleaning the deer. And it's really something, I think, to be aware of.
Jeff in Portage, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm from Portage, but I'm sitting in the parking lot at Conserve School in northern Wisconsin right now. And I want to, first of all, thank these three guys and Paul Smith from the Journal Sentinel, because you are the people who inform us about our natural resources. Mainstream media does not really keep us informed, nor are they that interested in the things I'm interested in, which are our natural resources. So thank you, guys.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
The thing I want to bring up is regarding the public trust doctrine. the waters of the state of Wisconsin are constitutionally protected, very clearly in our Constitution. There's been a distinct erosion of those protections over the past few years. Our legislature specifically can't give away that authority to take away the authority of the public to access our waters of the state. They're open for hunting, fishing, trapping, ice skating. And now we have a trend that's going different. The legislature is making decisions. Foxconn was one of them. To impact waters of the state in violation of the Constitution, I think.
Oh.
Some of you remember this argument before Peg Lautenschlager, when she was the Attorney General, said they can't do that, they can't do these things. And then the next Attorney General gave us a different opinion. But specifically in northwestern Wisconsin, we have lots of violations of water law, and we don't seem to be able to find an effective way of dealing with these things. Most of them are from sand mines. And we have to reaffirm this constitutional protection of the waters of our state. I mean, that's what Wisconsin is.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, I thank you very much for calling. Let's see if we can get some comments from one or more of our people. Tim, you want to start?
Sure. I very much agree with what Jeff says. I think that the public trust doctrine, which allows people to access different areas of the state, and that the resources are there for everybody. And, of course, the Department of Natural Resources holds our natural resources in trust for people. But we have access to all of these areas through the public trust doctrine. What we've seen is that the legislature in past years has nipped and tucked and taken some of those things away. And I think the key is, number one, citizens have got to be aware of what's going on, and they need to talk to their legislators and tell them that especially that the public lands and the public trusts are really important and they value them. And number two, we need a Department of Natural Resources which is strong on science. When the legislature took away the Science Services Bureau, and now the current governor tried to put, I think it was like five positions back in, and the legislature whittled that down. I think only gave us two or three scientists back in there. That is really important, that we've got science people in there who are basically able to work on these things, and then the law enforcement people who can enforce some of the infractions that have taken place. But I think Jeff is highlighting a concern, and I think people need to be aware of it.
Yeah. Any comment, Dean or Pat?
Yes, I can jump in here, unless Pat, you want to go through first.
Go ahead, Dean. I'll pick up.
All right. So I have heard a little bit about this. I mean, over the years, but then even more recently. And so there have been some criticisms. I'm not sure if I should mention names yet or not, but I'm thinking, why not? Our new Assistant Deputy Secretary of the DNR, Todd Ames, has been criticized a little bit in this respect as far as not doing enough to protect the public trust doctrine. And so I'm just on the edge of this thing right now. So I guess since callers like your current caller, was it Jeff?
Jeff, yeah.
Depends on us for news, this kind of news. I guess I better get to work.
Pat, what about you?
The one thing I'd say is that it's not like these legislators aren't aware of our concerns. I mean, they hear from pretty smart people in the environmental spectrum that make really good scientific arguments. I guess one of my comments I've made to different groups when they ask me to talk and when I write my columns is that this is where it really would help a lot if hunters would really put on the conservation cap they always like to brag about and bring the stuff and let their elected officials know that this matters to hunters, this matters to anglers, because we have a lot of credibility with folks out there, with the legislators. And so often, though, we don't really make our voices heard on what I think are real bedrock environmental concerns and what is more important, as Tim was saying, than our water resources in this state. And you know, we saw just recently in the legislature where they let the big farms, industrial farms in central Wisconsin pump all the water they want out of the groundwater. And there's all this information out there that the legislature heard and just ignored. And so this is where, again, we come back to this. In a democracy, you have to make your voices heard. Otherwise, you'll get overrun by people who make a louder voice. And hunters, I think, have a great platform. And unfortunately, we end up too often squandering our political forces on things that really don't matter, like, you know, complaining about not having enough deer. That is not something that is really going to keep our society moving forward. So I guess that's where I'll get off my pedestal stump there.
Yeah. Tim, you wanted to say one more comment, too.
Thank you. I just wanted to add two quick things. One is that I'm doing some research on a gentleman by the name of Paul Husting, who is in the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame, and he was the one who brought to a test case against the Diana Shooting Club up at Horicon, basically that allowed people onto that marsh and onto the water areas, which they were trying to cut off. So people like Husting and people who have fought for public rights to the waters are really important, and it's been a tradition in this state. But Dean brought up Todd Amm's name there, and I just wanted to mention that one of the things that he's now the deputy secretary, I believe, of the Department of Natural Resources, has got a lot of background in water, had worked for the Ohio DNR, and he was the water division administrator, I believe, for the DNR for about 7 years. And I know when the Senate Environmental Committee met on the confirmation of Preston Cole as the secretary of the Department of Natural Resources, Tom Tiffany, who's the Republican legislator from northern Wisconsin, had brought up Todd Amm's as far as a concern. And he said he thought that Amm's had overstepped his bounds, but Amm's, it had to do, as I understand it, with somebody who was trying to build something on a navigable waterway. So it's, and Tiffany was very concerned about that and said, well, he didn't know if he would vote for Preston Cole as secretary. A week ago, the state Senate had their committee meeting, and they did vote unanimously for Preston Cole as far as secretary of the DNR, and that will now have to go to the full Senate, and they'll have to vote. They don't have a vote scheduled as of now. But I think it's people who have done some things on long shorelines and are concerned about it, and it's a controversial thing, obviously, but it all goes back to protection of the public waterways, I think. And
So. There we go. Thank you so much, Jeff, for bringing this all up. Susan and Racine, your turn. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Say a couple fun things. First of all, Trillium, Petrifying Springs Park, right next to UW Parkside. Great spring flowers, including Trillium. So check that out.
Good.
Yeah, and then up north by Manitowish Waters, we saw my dog and I saw some grouse this year, and she was fascinated. She's a little shih tzu. She wanted to chase them. And then after that, we were still there a couple more weeks, and she would look for those grouse every day. And she just thought, well, they should be around here because they're running around like crazy. And they don't fly too much. So that was a lot of fun.
Susan, thanks so much for calling. So, Petrifying Spring Park. If you haven't seen Pat a Trillium in a while, that's the place to go next year, I guess.
Keep that in mind.
Absolutely. Doug and Trevor, it's your turn. Hi, Doug.
Hey. I'm asking you guys, what's the best time to go up to Horicon Marsh? I was up there 30 years ago, and it was just crazy. And I want to catch what's the peak time?
So are you up there to just shoot photos or just observe, or what are you talking about, Doug?
Observe. I don't want to hunt nothing. I just want to sit back and watch tens of thousands of birds.
All right. Well, there's a couple times of the day, I think. Yeah, Tim, go ahead.
Sure. I would think basically usually the last week of October used to be traditionally was the peak time that we would have migratory birds in the state as far as ducks and geese. When I know they've done counts on the Mississippi River, and usually that last week of October. And in Horicon, back years and years ago, Dick Hunt, who was the biologist up there, I think he said that the first geese started coming in about September 11th or 14th, and then those geese would be piling in. And as the ducks migrate down, I would think the last week of October, first week of November, good times to stop up there, and definitely stop at the state headquarters and also the federal headquarters. They have new exhibits there, and they have some neat things to see, and they have some new trails that go around. And so that'd be a great time to be there.
And if there's any hour of the day that you want to be there, the hour of the day I would want to be there is the hour before sunset. Yeah.
Good time.
They're coming in by the tens of thousands.
I'd say, too, Larry, if this guy was, if he's relying on his memories from 30 years ago of HorrorCon, you won't see those kind of numbers now, as you were saying, back a generation ago. And, and so I just don't want him to be disappointed if he shows up there and it doesn't see the just, I mean, it used to be, you know, dark in the sky type days and evenings up there where you'd just see so many geese in the air, and you'd go to bed with the goose music in your ear that you couldn't, you know, couldn't shake it. And in recent years, you know, their patterns have changed, and they don't come through in quite as big of numbers as they used to.
But they're still coming in that last hour.
Yep.
That's why I brought that time up for Doug, because if the most you're going to see it in the air at any one time is probably then, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. So there you go, Doug. Thanks so much. Well, you know, we never really got into crossbows and hunting. And I know that's something I wanted you to comment on, Pat, just the impact on of crossbows on deer hunting.
Yeah, you know, the last couple of years, for the first time, the crossbow harvest of deer has surpassed the regular harvest of, you know, from compound bows and to a smaller extent, recurve bows. And so it's been controversial, and some people are asking, as Dean can attest, some people are not just asking but demanding we cut back on the crossbow opportunities. And personally, I look at the numbers of deer being shot in the archery season with crossbows and compound bows, and then compare it with what we're shooting during the regular firearm season, and it's still not getting anywhere close to what we're shooting in the firearm season. So I still think it's a great opportunity for people to get out there and keep hunting and get out and hunt. If a guy doesn't like the fact the muzzleloader season is so late, well, the crossbow can get you out in mid-September. So I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, and on that note, and I know some people who have some physical disabilities that are able to actually use a crossbow where they can't anymore use the other types of bows. Well, here we are with a great 90 minutes, you guys. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I hope we have a chance to do it. You know, we try to do it spring, summer, winter, fall. And so let's agree to meet again in a few months and talk some more. How's that sound?
Great.
Great, Larry.
Yep, sounds good.
Thank you guys so much. Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. Patrick Durgan, freelance writer and editor, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. It's always great to have them come by. And they'll be back again, and we'll do another round table with them on some more wildlife issues for the particular season we're in. Tomorrow at 11, it's time to talk home improvement, so we'll talk masonry and water issues. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, there's lots more good things in store here on the Ideas Network, so you stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller, and thanks for listening.